Hey Mike, how you doing, man?
Prepared, man. What's good? I'm feeling fantastic. How you feeling over there, man?
I'm feeling good. It's Saturday morning. I'm in my office. It's kind of gray outside. I see a bunch of Buckeyes coming in, the Ohio State Northwestern game. We're about to get a proper ass whooping.
You have no faith early.
No. I mean, I hope they win. It's like they're like eight, Ohio State's like 8-1. We're like I don't know what we are, but I'm doing well, man. I'm doing well. Welcome back, everybody. I'm Saper Vakil, your co-host.
I'm your co-host, Michael Knight, and this is Professional Comedian Walking to a Bar. Special episode today, Superior.
This is PCWB, guys. We're on a roll. We're talking. We have two special guests today. One of them, I'm going to go ahead and introduce one of our guests. He's a special friend. We go back to my Texas day. Dr. Juan Carrillo is coming here virtually from Arizona, professor in the teacher school there at Arizona State University. Really happy to have you on, Juan.
Appreciate it, man. Happy to be here.
Yeah, dope. And my guest for the day is comedian Anthony Fuentes, former Army, about as New York, like the definition of New York. Was it the Bronx and
Nah, Brooklyn.
Brooklyn? All right, so that's what it is. And then also like one of the standout comics in the Chicago area. Everybody knows him, everybody loves him. I believe you just did your hour at Zany's. I know you're a mainstay on every stage in the city. Also, you're on the road normally throughout the year. And you got another big show coming up at the Den Theater in a few months. So
Right.
to see your success exploding like this, man, which I knew it was going to for a long time, is so dope to see, and I'm glad that you're here.
Thank you, brother. Thanks for having me, man. I'm
Yeah,
excited.
absolutely. Absolutely. It's dope.
Absolutely. Absolutely. So yeah, Juan and Anthony, man, welcome to our experiment. We're kind of we're I don't know, we're like six, seven episodes into this project. And just to give you guys a little bit of context, is what is this, right? Why are we bringing together professors and comedians for our listeners and also for our guests? Like this is very simply an attempt to bring together artists and educators and academics to talk about ideas, man. I'm a big fan of the comedy world. I'm an observer, and I think what you guys do is so important to society, and I'm a professor, so and I'm in the realm of talking and ideas and discourse, and I met Mike, and we had a lot of overlap in terms of ideas and point of view, but it's two different worlds, and they're not often brought together, right? And so what we're trying to do is bring them together, not with any particular agenda. We're trying to have a good time, have a good conversation. It's Saturday morning, but the world is the world. There's a lot to talk about,
Yeah.
right? And so it's kind of a mix of a bunch of guys, in this case, a bunch of guys getting together. I have my coffee. It's a professor and comedian walking to a bar, but this morning it's a coffee shop.
There you
So
go.
that's pretty much the vibe of what we're doing. So Mike, where should we begin, man? I'm gonna kick it off to you.
I'll tell you
Yeah,
exactly where we
where do
should
we
begin.
go?
Let's cut the malarkey, gents. Why didn't black and Hispanic men vote Democrat this election? No,
And don't leave our people out, Mike. Don't leave our
I'm
people out, man. I'm from I'm from
just...
uh
Muslims?
I mean, that's a broad
Hey,
brush.
That's
Kanye.
crazy.
I don't know. I voted for Kanye, so.
Can I ask you, is there a is everybody I'm surprised at the how easy everything transitioned. If I'm being honest, regardless of which way that it went, I thought there was about to be smoke in the city, man. I thought we was gonna be watching Canadian news and they was gonna be talking about the southern border crisis. Did it surprise you, like how kind of easy and simple the transition happened this time?
No, I didn't think it was. I kind of know. I mean, it's 2024. People don't overreact. I mean, we overreact, but not in a violent way. I feel like, people are just like they kind of expected it. I think they're like, listen, it could go the other way, but if it does, it is what it is. I want to know all those people that was running off at the mouth talking about, I'm leaving this country. No asses at Starbucks right now. Kimball and Armistead over there getting a call from like, why are you still here? Why are you still? You wasn't here. No, 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 but the other
That's
than that,
what I'm talking about.
I kind of expect. I think for the fact that the government set a precedent when they stormed the Capitol, and people saw the time that the people that stormed were getting, because some got 20 years, some so they're like, yo, I ain't trying to do no time. They, you know, and
yeah.
We're just like, yo, let's chill, because they're going to be watching.
Yeah. Well, we're in the Midwest, Juan. You're in Arizona. Arizona. And that's south. That's about as south as you get. Was there a different, what was the feeling in the air?
Yeah, man. Yeah, good question. You know, I feel you used the word fatigue before we got started. I feel something between fatigue in terms of my colleagues and friends and people on the block, fatigue, stress, maybe anxiety. You know, put that word out there. A lot of anxiety about what happened, how could it have happened, who did it, who didn't do it. There's a lot of anxiety around the numbers. Like, did Latino men really vote more for Trump versus Kamala? Because the new numbers are saying it actually wasn't the case. So then there's anxiety and distrust of the mainstream media around that. Did Latinos in general, writ large, vote for Trump, right? Versus Kamala, that's another thing. People are saying, wait a minute, look at the numbers. Let's disaggregate the data.
Right.
Most Mexicans, I'm Chicano, West Coast, you know, South Central, food stamps. That's my story, right, from that block. Mm. But 65%, I think I heard the latest. It feels like some places are still counting, man. By the end of the day, Kamala might win. You know, I don't know, man. But 65% of, I heard, latest numbers, Puerto Ricans voted for Kamala, and 63% or so Mexican origin people voted for Kamala, and the Cubans went mostly, you know, to the R side.
The
but
Cubans,
it's, still,
it's
yeah,
always
of
the
course.
Cubans.
Well, you know, there's that story of political trauma. See, when I was a kid in Cali, there was this guy named Jorge Ramos, you know, Mexicano, who used to come on, and, you know, as I was trying to figure out this thing called the English language, he would just be like, buenos dias, you know, Univision, he would just, da-da-da-da-da. And he became big. He moved to Miami. And his daughter, who worked for Vice, she wrote a book about the movement of some Latinos to the right, right? And I was trying to catch it. I haven't read the book, but I heard some interviews. And, you know, her angle, you know, lives in Miami, is that the Cuban story and the story of some groups within, because it's not a monolith, right? There's differences. And it's also like urban, rural. There's a lot of things going on. It's too nuanced. She talks about, like, look, man, you know, there's a lot of political trauma. There's some communities that come from a certain kind of political trauma and leans their vote a certain way versus others. There's
communism
that.
In Cuba, yeah.
Right, that kind of stuff. So, but I feel in Arizona, you asked Arizona, man, it's an interesting place for me, because I shouldn't even say Arizona. I should say the Finiquera, Phoenix, right? You got a city like Tempe, where I'm at, that goes blue. You got maybe the city, what is it? I could throw a tennis ball. Nah, maybe not that far. My arm's not that strong, but I'm right by the city of actual Phoenix. That goes blue. And then there's some suburbs that have been tinkering between like blue and red, or going more red. And it was the last election, it went to Biden in this election.
That's right.
It went to Trump. But within the state level, two senators are Democrat, the governor's Democrat. It's purple.
Interesting.
It's that purple flavor. And there's a strong contingency, man, of independent voters, people that don't want to, like, supposedly pick a side, and they kind of like move in different directions. But I feel the anxiety of the people, the text messages I get. My partner, she's like, man, you need to get that dual citizenship. You need to go to the consulate. You stop messing around. We might have to hit up an Airbnb. We might have to do a bed and breakfast in Mexico. She's on that too. Like, it's time to bounce, you know? So it's a lot of stress, a lot of anxiety around, what does this mean for, you know, our community here, from the people I'm with?
I think it's so important, though, Juan, that you kind of pointing to the nuance, and I appreciate you bringing those numbers out, because sometimes people get carried away with the narrative, right? Latinos went to Trump. Hold on a second. Which ones, right? Let's get into the data, and let's not, you know, I think we even touched on that, Mike, in our last episode, where if you do look at the numbers, it does tell a different story. So we can't jump to conclusions. So I appreciate you bringing that nuance. But Anthony, to your earlier point too, but you and Mike talking about, like, you know, the day after, people are still getting their Starbucks, right? I see where you're going with that, and I think you're onto something. But I have to also point out that, you know, it's because it's the Democrats, right? It's the Starbucks group. It's like, if Trump had lost, Do we think it would have been the same calm in the streets? I don't think so, right? So I think one side, right? And I'm just saying, I'm just, you know, and I could be wrong, right? But like, let's, I think if, I think the fact that everything has been so peaceful, in a way, it's a credit to, you know, Biden and Kamala and the Democrats, because they, hey, that's like, we lost. You can't be a sore loser. We got our ass kicked decisively. So isn't there something to be said for like, hey, we didn't want the outcome. I didn't want that outcome. But I'm not, you know,
I don't.
I'm not like they cheated. I'm not about to storm the Capitol. I'm like, shit, man, we got work to do.
I think what it was is, I think deep down, Kamala and the Democratic Party knew they lost the moment Biden stepped down. You know, it was just too, there wasn't a time. You know, you the Democratic Party, what killed us was they lied the entire time. No, Biden's coherent. Biden's perfectly fine.
Right.
Biden's great. And then we saw that debate and we was like, yo, Biden's not okay. That he's doing worse than my grandfather. I couldn't understand. I rewound. Yeah. I thought there was like subliminal. maybe if you play it backwards, you could hear what
he like a Beatles album.
Yeah. I was like, oh, this you gotta play backwards to understand what he's saying. It was so bad at one point I put closed caption and the TV game. That's bad, bro. That's bad. And the moment that happened, it really hindered the Democratic Party, because it was then that the next day they had to admit, okay, he's not okay. Well, we've been saying this, but you guys waited
so long.
And then you only give this poor woman, what, a month, 2 months?
A month and a half. Yeah.
A month and a half? It's not enough time. It's not enough. You can't get her to be engaged with the people in 2 months. Remember, she's been the VP, so she's kind of been quiet as the VP because she's just been supporting Joe and doing things here. But for her to be a woman of the people, you had to give her the entire time to work in this campaign. You did it. You gave her a month and a half. I mean, I think they knew then this is going to really bite us. It's going to really bite us. Not only that, something I talked about before, and it's really sickening. It's just, I'm just tired of it. You know, on both parties, you know, they're bringing, you know, Tony Heathcliff. I'm not going to call him by his right name because he called my island trash. They brought in, you know.
This is about to ask you.
Yeah, they brought in Tony Heathcliff. They got Nicki Jam because she's so hot. They got it. And then on the other side, you got Taylor Swift and you're bringing Beyonce, Cardi B. How about instead of taking the time to spend money on these celebrities, how about you spend it on what needs to be spent on? Or how about instead of bringing celebrities, you spend time telling us what your plan is to fix the country? I don't care about
Cardi B.
I don't care about Nicki Jam. They don't have the same bills that I had. They didn't have to make a payment plan with the light company to a year ago. You understand? You know what I mean? Like, you don't got the same problems I got. So you being on stage means nothing to me. I didn't want to watch a concert. I want to see a rally. I want to see what you plan on doing about fixing this. And both parties it's you don't see, you didn't see that back in the day. Like the presidents went there themselves. They engaged with the people. They spoke to the people. They spoke about what they planned on doing, what they planned on changing, and how they planned on changing it. We never heard much of a game plan from either side. You know, it was always celebrity, 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 and then come talk for 10 minutes. And it's
more. You're absolutely right. To that point, kind of in the same realm, something I wanted to ask you on. Immigration, the border. It's something that has always, always, always been a topic for as long as I can remember. And I think it was, what, the tail end of Obama's or the first run for Trump. You know, you're seeing videos every day of young kids on the border in, like, camps with aluminum blankets on them. And you're seeing this every day. And then one day they just stop showing it on the news. And it's not like all those people just poof disappeared. Is this still, so when something doesn't get coverage, you stop, you know, out of sight, out of mind. Is there still, is this dinner table talk in the Hispanic household about like the border crisis and if Trump's elected and he's looking at, you know, exporting people or this, that, and the third? Like what's the sense in the community?
Yeah. Well, you know, if I stay in my lane in terms of my lived experience and like the stuff that I hear in my specific spaces, you know, my partner is from Mexico, born and raised, born across the border from El Paso, Ciudad Juárez. It's like literally you could see when you're on that highway right there. I don't know, Anthony, if you ever been done comedy in El Paso, you could see Juárez right there. Like,
It's literally right next to, it's right there at the
you know what
border.
I'm talking about. So, that so I go. I love the question because I tell students this all the time. See, and hopefully it gets to something related to your question, but the Mexico that I go to is the Mexico of like dinner, mentorship, jokes, a melancholy about what was lost in the neighborhood, how it's changed so much. It's about the elders kind of coming through and telling me that they knew my father, rest in peace. I get a lot of stuff like that, like a lot of like unpacking of that other side of me that sometimes doesn't come back to me when I'm on this side of the border. So I cross all the time and I have the privilege to cross, but it's kind of like that ancestral memory recollections that happen. So when people say border
That's deep.
deportations, the criminality, I'm not saying there aren't layers to this, but when people say all that, to me, it's always an archive, like a DJ trying to archive, going to go back to the history of hip hop or salsa or whatever. It's always, on my father's side, there are banda singers or musicians. They play that banda music, the kind of like that polka sounding music. And so when I go to Sinaloa, people all over Netflix, Chapo Guzman, Chapo Guzman. But when I go to Sinaloa, it was my sister's wedding in December. My daughter wanted to get on a horse for a dollar. A gentleman said, "You got a couple of pesos, she can go around the church 10 times on the horse and say she's been on a horse." Then we get a little churro or some carne asada tacos on the spot right there, cobblestone streets in a little town. Then I saw a guy painting a museum of this famous Mexican band called Los Tigres del Norte. They were from that same neighborhood. So that's kind of like the way I'm processing this idea of like the border and who comes and who doesn't come. It's a more, I think, communal reality that I experienced. But having said that, yes, sometimes people at the dinner table on the Mexico side or on the state side, they do tell their stories about immigration, about how they came, how they slept on a hill, and then they waited at a certain time to cross through, or how I'll never know the true story. My father's no longer here to kind of, document this, but he said, "You know what's crazy?" He told me one day, he said, "I got on a plane from Culiacán, Sinaloa, Mexico, where we're from." Well, we're kind of around there. He said, "And I came in as a professor. Like that was my identity, to try to get to the States and find a job." And he goes, now you're a professor, but I wasn't like really a professor, but you are." And so like those are the kind of like connections that I hear all the time. And maybe to flip it, maybe that sounds too much like a Walt Disney story. I don't know how that sounds like to the other side that's listening, but
No,
maybe
that was fine.
what's that?
I said that was fine. No, I really appreciated what you were talking about, how you had to go back to connect with your culture just to kind of like recharge the battery in your soul. It's like when Superman has to fly to the middle of the sun to get strong again.
Exactly. So I so like I think I got a couple of phone calls about someone just hit me up on a text message, and I think we talked about hoops before we met up, and they said, "Hey, my bro-in-law, one of my favorite peoples in the world, he's in Juarez, that dangerous city called Juarez, right? He's like, hey my man, he's like, before you hit the road in about 8 days, Thanksgiving, make sure you bring that NBA 2K so we could play it till 5 in the morning." Those are the
That's
things
right.
I remember when I hear border. I'm like, oh, he wants me to bring the NBA 2K so we could play till 5 in the morning, and then we're gonna make runs to the local neighborhood spot to get some food as we're like getting hungry across the day. But I was gonna say, my father-in-law on my wife's side, maybe this is something that y'all can break down. But he said one day, he said this. I'm not saying I agree or whatever, but he said this. He said, "You know what?" He said, "This whole border thing and this whole Trump thing," he goes, "sometimes Trump is more hot air than actual action. A lot of the stuff is to get elected. A lot of the stuff is to get elected, and then eventually he's not going to be able to get what he wants." I'm not saying I agree or disagree
Yeah.
or whatever. Yeah, but I remember him saying that and kind of like messing up the table conversation a little bit, because he's like, just know he runs hot. He runs hot, and he uses all those focus groups about what goes hot so that people can be afraid enough to vote for him. But then the reality, once he's in, he gets some things through, but a lot of things don't go through. But I don't know. So there's those
There's a
kind of
lot.
dynamics. Yeah, those
Can I
kind
tell you real quick, Juan, something that I really identified
of. Go for it.
with what you were just talking about is that how you were saying, like, when people hear, about Sinaloa and these other places, on the outside observer, you're just going off of Netflix, HBO shows, whatever's on your feed, and you go, ah. So I've been in Chicago for 13 years, and I spent 11 and a half of those on the South Side between Bronzeville and like Washington Park. And I've seen it all. But like for me, when I'm in that neighborhood or when I go to that neighborhood, I see my, you know, the spot that I go get my shoes from. I see the spot where I can go get, you know, a gyro or whatever like that. Like for me, I'm comfortable in that zone. But from the outside observer, they're like, wait, where do you live? Man, I ain't coming over there, man. You come over to my house or something like that, you know? And it's, is there something to that? Is it actually kind of what I wanted to get into? Is that a, are we conditioned? We talked a little bit before we got online about, mental health, especially in our communities in particular, right? The Hispanic culture for men is very machismo oriented. For Black men is very machismo oriented. For Sapir, he's coming from a Muslim background, it's very machismo oriented. And that could be seen as soft. But when you're in like Sinaloa, do you have that blanket of security just because you might be not institutionalized, but you're just like, oh, okay, I know the spots. I know what's hot. Like, and when you're in Brooklyn, I go to Brooklyn, I'm going to remember everything that Biggie Smalls was saying on Ready to Die. I'm going to be like, no, I can't be in Flatbush. I can't be in this place. I can't be in that place. Even though I heard they gentrified now, but are we institutionalized when we're there? Anymore. Huh?
I say you ain't got nothing to worry about in Brooklyn anymore. It's been gentrified.
That's what I'm hearing.
I don't recognize my neighborhood anymore.
Are we institutionalized in these areas though? Or are they changing around us? Did we change and we didn't notice?
No, I think it's just, you know, people saw value in our neighborhoods. You know, once they open the Barclays Center,
that part.
People can say, well, there's money here. And, you know, it's sad, but when they see money, they don't see us. They see past us. What can we make once they're gone? And so, you know, we, you know, all those older people that lived in New York that had rent control, you know, they've lived in New York for 30 plus years, and New York has gotten so congested and so bad that it's the cost of living has skyrocketed beyond compare. The parking is impossible to find. It's just, everybody's angry. So you come to somebody, you offer them $30,000 to move. You see $30,000, it's your scapegoat. So, Florida, I could do this. But what you're really doing is you've now given your two bedroom, $750 a month apartment to a man who's bought this building, guts it. You understand? Makes it 2 one-bedrooms, rents them for $1,500 each, as opposed to $750 that was coming in. And a commute from Brooklyn to Manhattan is only about a 20-minute subway train commute to get there. So instead of living for $3,000 a month in a studio, I can take a 20-minute commute and pay $1,500 for a one-bedroom. And so now all those Manhattan people came from Manhattan, moved into Brooklyn. You understand? Now Brooklyn is not Brooklyn anymore. Brooklyn has lost its culture. It's lost its people. You know, I grew up in a neighborhood where we'd have the fire hydrant pump open every morning. We'd steal the crepe from the Asian laundromat and cut it whole in it and play crepe ball all day. And we played manhunt. We played stickball. Now there's not a soul out there. There's people walking poodles on mopeds and freaking, you know, so they've really taken culture from New York. But to touch base on what you guys were talking about immigration, you know, I here's the thing. America has always preached, you know, people are like, oh my God, the culture, you know, the immigrants are coming, but this is what we've been preaching since day one. Bring us your tired and hungry.
That's right.
It represents that, you know, like so, you know, it does bug me when we're so adamant about all the immigrants are doing this, but you know what? We've welcomed, we've asked them to come. We've shown the world that, hey, if you want a dream to come true, if you want to make it, come to America. So don't get mad now that they're coming. We've asked them, we've been telling this for 175 years. Hey, if times are hard, come to America. This is the home of the free, land of the brave. This is where you make it. This is where you have an opportunity. So don't get mad that they're trying to find a way out, because they're going through the same thing that those people in New York who grew up since the 70s were looking for, a way out, you know?
Is this the best system that we have, do you think? Is there something that could change on the system that you could think of?
Listen, it's clearly broken. I don't know. But I do know that the people who are suffering, that we are failing to realize, is not just the immigrants, it's the immigrant children. You know, I perform for immigrants, Venezuelan immigrants in Chicago. They asked me, come down, you know, they need to be cheered up. And I walked into the shelter and it broke my heart, bro. The shopping carts filled with bottles of water that ain't even cold, they're warm. You know what I'm saying? Little plastic bowls with punch of Cheerios. Okay, talk the schmack you want that, oh, they're getting this much of link and they're getting this much food stamps. Doesn't matter, bro. They're scared. They're in a country they've never been. They have no family here. They have no friends here. They're scared. You understand? I don't care if I offer you $5,000. If you're scared, you still don't know what to do. And everybody's mad at you that you're there. And you're like, why? You guys told us to come here. You understand? And this little kid, his name was David. He was 9 years old. We talked after I was leaving. He asked me if he can get a picture. And I was like, yeah. And he's like, oh, my God, he took a picture with me. And the people who worked there took the picture. They had a phone. They're like, we'll take a picture. You know, you can't take pictures, but we'll take a picture. Fine. And I asked him, so what do you want to do when you grow up? And it broke my heart. He said, I want to be a soccer player, but I know it's never going to happen because I'm in the wrong place. Is that what we become? A place that you went to accomplish your dream to now, a place where it's not going to happen because you're in this place. That broke my heart, man. You know, I went, I bought him a soccer ball. I said, man, follow your dreams. Don't let nobody tell you no. And when I went back to checking them, they had disappeared. Now they're somewhere in Kansas. I lost contact with him in a month. But you see, they are the ones suffering.
Wow. Wow.
And we're so focused on what we're going through that we're failing to focus on what's important, the kids. Because those kids, guess what? They're our future generation. They're not going anywhere. You understand? They're going to be here for the next 20 years. Now, do we want to make them upstanding citizens? Or do we want to leave them as kids who have to struggle for everything and end up as a product of the system?
That's right. Understand?
Don't sit there and preach to me about, oh, they're criminals. We're making them criminals when we're not helping them. Because guess what? Desperate times call for desperate measures. I grew up in the hood. I grew up with nothing. You understand? And there was times I robbed. There was times I stole. There was times I sold drugs. I had to do what I had to do to survive. And that's what you're forcing these people to do. So don't tell me that they're criminals. You're forcing them. How about help them? You know, let's not, you know, and it's getting to the point where, like, in New York, I hear everybody in New York complains about, oh, the immigrants. We're all immigrants, moron. We're all, we all migrated here. You understand? What happened to New York? We used to be a culture, a melting pot of culture, you know? And now we're mad because Venezuelans are here. Is it getting out of control? Yeah, but they need to make a living. So you go to New York and you'll drive by a street and there's 45 mopeds bundled up because that's all they can do is delivery because no one wants to give them a chance because the moment they go apply for a job, you're like, nah, you're an immigrant. Well, then don't get mad when they fill up the streets with mopeds, because guess what? At the end of the day, at least they're trying to work. You understand? I know people grew up, were born in this country and get food stamps. And guess what? They're happy with us. And I ain't got to work. I got food stamps. You understand?
Yeah.
Give me five. I will take five immigrants that want to work any day over somebody that doesn't want to work and is happy living off food stamps. You understand? Because those five, they know what they want. They want to see. They want something, yo. They want a dream. So we have to remember that. And I hope that people can remember that because honestly, it took me going to perform at that shelter to see for myself what they're going through.
And Anthony, I'm going to ask you a question. Was that performance at the shelter, was that post-election?
It was pre-election.
Pre-election. Yeah. A question I had, I was going to ask you, is have you had a show yet? Have you been on stage after the election?
Oh yeah, I'm on stage every day.
Okay, so if we can go there for a minute, because Mike and I a few days ago in his studio, we kind of had this compare and contrast. We swapped stories about the day after the election. You know, what is it like for a comedian getting on stage, kind of with all of these ideas, all of these different themes, and then I shared mine, and I'm curious now to ask you, Anthony, and you, Juan, what's it been like? How have you engaged? You know, being in Chicago. Being who you are, what you care about, and your background, and the content of your set.
Well, me is this, you know, I don't ever apologize for a joke. I live by that. You know, I grew up in the days of watching Paul Mooney, George Carlin, Red Fox, Eddie Murphy, you know.
Sticks and stones, break my bones.
The people who never apologize, you understand? They made waves. They pushed the envelope. They challenged the opposite, you understand? And that's what made them great. And that's how I try to conduct myself on stage. I don't do politics on stage because I'm like, yo, you came to laugh. My job is to make you laugh. And at the end of the day, you know, we're talking about mental health. There's people in the audience that it really is freaking out. You know, they were freaked out by this. Why? Dude, so,
facts.
But I can't judge you for it because it's your mental space. You understand? And I would appreciate if you respect my mental space. So who am I to judge yours? But that being said, they're going through it. You understand? Every day they're nervous. Oh my God, what's going to happen? And it's not that they're whether they're on the blue or the red, it's their mental space. So when you come to a show, shouldn't you be able to forget about it? Shouldn't you be able to forget about the problems? My goal, you know, when I started comedy, I started to help and cope with my PTSD, my post-traumatic stress disorder. And so I use that now as an opportunity to help others. You understand? So when I'm up there, I'm talking smack. And and I tell people off the bat, there's times I do talk politics, but I do it in a tasteful way where I mock both parties. You understand? I mock both because they're both morons. At the end of the day, I'm sorry. They're both morons because the problem isn't the people, you know, with these people. What bugs me is this. We depend on one person to make a difference when it's you, me. We, the people that can make a difference. We, the people can stop world hunger. We, the people can fight to help the inflation. We, the people can make a difference, but we choose to work and depend on one person because that's what we become. So when I'm on stage, I try to, you know, the day after the election, I talk smack about it because I was like, we got to laugh.
You got to.
Laugh about it.
There's no way around
everybody's
it.
Everybody's like that with their butthole tight. You know, everybody's not. Everybody's uncomfortable. No. Let's get this shit over with. Let's break the ice. Let's have some fun. Let's joke about it. And you know, I joked about it the first day. I made fun of it.
That's dope.
And you
got it to go. How was the audience reaction?
Oh, they were cracking up because I find a way to make fun of the whole situation.
Right.
And I think I actually let. I was like, you guys did a good vote. I voted for Reagan, bro. It didn't work. And you know, but it just helps that because you know. You have to learn, like you looked at these TV hosts, you know, these late night hosts, and they were all talking and trying to make jokes, but they were like painting a sad picture. The next day, I did a post because I kept seeing all this, everybody sad and mad, and I hate that. I'm like, life's too short, you understand? You spend more energy being mad than you do loving somebody. So I went and I put a simple post. Hey, everybody, have a great day. And remember to laugh, because that's my saying. I said my slogan. Remember to laugh.
Remember to laugh.
And somebody, one of the comments, said, America died yesterday. Bro, you're so dramatic. Relax. Relax. Okay.
Speaking of dramatic, Juan, were you in class the next day?
Man, I'm listening, and I got a story, if it's cool.
Yeah.
Maybe I could throw some humor in it, because it starts off a little serious, but... So when I was listening, I was thinking of this, you know, this whole idea of mental health and the useful immigrant. I don't know if that was clear through my dollar store headphones, the useful immigrant, like the immigrant that's useful, like you got to be useful to like be allowed in, that whole idea. And so there's all this like unpacking we could do about this idea of like the humans that have to be useful in order for them to come through and be in the block and be in the neighborhood and be Americanized and be accepted. And I was like, man, where can I take it on a personal side? So I thought about this because we talked about this pre-recording about therapy, right? So one day I showed up on a Zoom call because my father passed. I was kind of struggling. And it kind of told my brain, hey, you need to keep going. It's moved on beyond your father. But like there's other things you got to like figure out. So one day the therapist, like right here, like this background, she was like right here. Looking at me. And she goes, so what's up? What's the topic? And I said, you know what? It's been a good day, actually. I don't know. But she goes, no, you got to know, like, bring something up, like, so I can dialogue with you. And we were already at that point, you know, where it was like natural, like flow. I was like, man, you know, I am paying her, you know, like I should come up with something. My insurance only covers so much. So I'm like, OK, I got it. And I just threw something, like I just threw it and see if it would come back. So let's see if it connects to what we're talking about. Mental health, maybe. And like the immigrant experience or whatever. So then I said, look, you know, I got a little story for you. And she goes, OK, go drop it on me. We got 45 minutes since like you were just daydreaming for the first 15. I said, okay. I said, you know, back in the day, man, like 2005, 6-ish, my wife, who back then was not my, you know, wife. It was like, we're dating Claudia. We were getting a PhD at the University of Texas at Austin. And she would do something like really basic. And she goes, well, what would she do? She goes, she would pick me up from the airport. And she goes, okay. I go, yeah, like I would fly in, you know, from a conference or whatever, and she would pick me up. And not only she would pick me up, but she would take me to eat. She'd be like, all right, you pick the spot, you know, Welcome back home. It's good seeing you again. And Kirby Lane, I know it's a pair. You remember Kirby Lane, all these places in Austin? She goes, you want to go there? You want to get some Asian food, some Mexican food? And I go, and it was cool. It was a basic thing. Like my wife picked me up at the airport and we went to eat. But one day I said, this thing called having children came through. I started having kids. And when the children came through, my wife one day said, hey, you're a professor, I'm a professor, we got kids, time is limited, you're gonna have to find an Uber or like drive yourself and find a parking garage and take care of that. I said, totally makes sense, man. Like, life is complicated, we got kids, it's not the same time, that time has gone. So I said, I got you, no, don't worry, you didn't even have to bring it up. So I started going at parking garages or Ubering and everything, and about the fourth time that I had to do that, I started getting a little sad. And so I was telling the therapist this. I go, man, I started feeling sad. And I was like, why am I sad? Because I loved the whole like you pick you up and I would pick her up, I would pay it forward, and it was gone. And I go, I started feeling like, wait a minute. Like I understand there's no time for this maybe anymore, but I'm not feeling right about this. And I don't know if it's right, I'm in the right to bring it up. And then she goes, why were you feeling sad? And I said, I don't know. I just felt like something was lost, like I can't regain it, and I don't think I have the right to bring it up because like I understand her focus or her point of view, and she said something like this, and I always have my memories always kind of mess up the way she explained it, but she said something like this. She goes, "Tell me about growing up." She goes, "How were you in school?" I was like, "Oh man, I tried really hard to get straight A's and do this thing called go to college. It was like this big thing because everybody in my family, my immediate family, went to third grade. It was a struggle. They immigrated. And I was trying to pay it back and show respect for the journey and be like, I'm gonna go hard. I'm gonna go hard on the school thing and fight the good fight in the community and see how I can, be of support. So I'm gonna go hard." I go, she goes, "But how many times did your family come through at the graduations or like take a picture with you with your diploma with a big smile?" I was like, probably never. Like, I don't think they even went to my high school graduation, or if they did, it was late. And she goes, "Okay, what about when you got the PhD? Did they come to your graduation?" I was like, "Nah, they couldn't afford it." And I was trying to figure it out. They said they were busy, or And then she goes, "Okay, what about when you got this thing called tenure? What happened?" I go, "I had to go buy my own cake. Like, it was a day I got tenure, and I was like visiting families, trying to show some love before I hit the airport." And I was like, told my wife, "Man, I should get a cake, right? Like, don't you celebrate things like this? Like, 6 years of grinding for the academy and trying to do the good work, whatever that means, and I guess I'm gonna get a cake." So she goes, "All right." She goes, "When your partner stopped picking you up, she kind of hit a wound. You had this wound about this idea. I guess I'm gonna bring it back to what I said the first 10 seconds about the useful human or the useful immigrant, and I think I still have that wound when I hear people talk about the useful immigrant. I remember that even without it meaning to, my own family told me in direct and indirect terms, my immediate family, that once I made the money and once I got a career, that I had to pay. I had not that I don't want to, but that I had to get them a house. I had to get them this. They went down the list. It became transactional. The relationship, maybe there's too much information, but the relationship became very transactional. So she goes, "So in your situation with your partner, which both sides are right, life gets busy, you're like reminded of that about your role as a transactional human to a lot of people that you love." And it was like that lime on that cut in your gum, getting that root canal, you don't want to put some lime on it. It's like it hit. And I think that's a part that is also kind of painful for me is to kind of like see that, right? While I understand the micro realities of like how people feel economically or how they feel about different issues, is the whole idea of who gets access to just being alive and shooting some jumpers from the free throw line, and who gets framed through a transactional lens. Because for so much of my life, I've had to face that, right? Of course, I have privileges. I'm born in the States, and I'm not trying to compare myself to someone who's undocumented. But yeah, and so I've been on that journey, on a mental health tip to like. Not sure if you wanted to go that route, but kind of figure that side out.
Actually, that brings up a question that I have. What are, if we were talking to our communities, what stereotypes are they getting wrong about therapy? Because like I said it already, I'm in therapy. I'm not going to speak out of school for anybody else here, but what is, if I was to go to the barbershop right now and be like, hey, how many of y'all is in therapy? it might be my last cut. It might be my last line, and they kick me out. But what are they getting wrong? What do they not understand about it?
Well, because they make therapy sound like it's you're crazy. You understand? You hear therapy, you're like, oh, you're crazy. You understand? Only crazy people see therapists. And, you know, it's not, you know. And also, too, you know, people think with the old school mentality, oh, you know, I used to be that way before I encountered what I encountered. But, oh, you're depressed. Get over it.
Rub some dirt on it.
You sad? Get over it. You know, be happy. You know, and it's not something that ever heals. It sticks with you for the rest of your life. There's times I still have nightmares. Can't do nothing about it. You know, it's just part of processing. It's part of your life. It's something that don't go away. But I've learned to wear the wound proudly. I'm an advocate for people with mental health because I wear the wound proudly. You don't have to hide it. Don't hide it. You know, talk about it. You know, and that's why I do shows for VFWs and soldiers who might have been through what I've been through. That's why I do shows for mental health. That's why I do shows for the Wounded Warrior Project, because I want to come and connect with you and understand, and make you understand. Don't be afraid or ashamed to talk about it. It's not a sickness. It's just something that happened. People keep calling it a sickness. Stop calling it a sickness. You understand? Because sickness, what does it sound like? Ill, get away from me. You understand?
No. Contagious?
Contagious. No. It's not a sickness. It's a disease. It's something that you have to live with. It's something that happened. It's trauma. You understand? And if you don't understand it, don't judge upon it. You know, that's the problem. You know, everybody wants to have an opinion nowadays. And, you know, and I live by this method. Screw your opinion. You understand? All that matters at the end of the day is your own opinion. Nobody can change your own opinion. How you feel and who you are is all that matters. You understand? The problem is, to elaborate on what my brother Juan was saying, you know, you become the same way you feel you have to please others. I have to my family. I have to do this because I don't want them to feel this way about me. I don't, because we ourselves have been taught that all our lives, you know, don't piss them off. Because then you're going to be, you know, and we have to learn to rise above that and not let that affect us mentally. Because again, you shouldn't have to go into a barbershop and with that mentality, if I talk about my therapist, it'll probably be my last haircut. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
And you know, I remember telling, and what I do like, and I have noticed that in the last 3-4 years, mental health has taken
a higher
attention span now. And people are kind of like, hey man, let's be more aware. Let's be more conscious about people, how they're feeling and what they're thinking. You understand? And that's one thing I do like and have noticed because, you know, when I first was diagnosed with PTSD was in 2004. And people didn't know what the hell that was. You know, my mother didn't know. I talk about it on stage. It's a true story. When I told my mother I had PTSD, she cried over the phone. And she was like, hey, papi, why are you sleeping with the prostitutes? And I'm like, what? I thought it was an STD. And I'm like, man, no, it's not an STD. I'm like, it's PTSD. And then, you know, for the next time, she was treating me like I was a mental patient. Hey, papi. Come here, come sit down. And I'm like, relax, man. But, you know, now people are making aware and creating awareness for it. And, you know, I remember I told a lady one time, she was like, what do you do for them? I was like, I'm a comedian. She's like, oh, you're depressed. And I'm like, thank you. I am, but now I'm more. Thank you. You know,
I'm a comedian. Sorry to hear that.
And you know, when Juan was talking about, you know, with his wife, you know, it's something to him, to you, you know, it's something to others. It's like, really? But it's deep for you. You understand? And people have to respect that, you know?
That part right there, and that's actually, sorry to cut you off. That's something that I struggled with as well, is conceptualizing that everybody's trauma is personal to them. You hit on it earlier. Something powerful, everything you just said was powerful, by the way, and something powerful that Juan was just talking about, that touched me, not for nothing, when he was talking about, hey, you know, I didn't even notice that when I looked up and looked around, all of my accomplishments, I was by myself, I bought my own cake or whatever, and between and anybody that's on here, I've seen it all, and this actually just happened in one of my recent therapy sessions. Is I was given a rundown of some of the crazier things I've been through or seen in my life. And then I told my therapist, like right after it, I was like, yeah, but it doesn't bother me because I know people that had it 10 times worse. And she was like, no, Don't do that. Because now you're shoving what is actually bothering you off to the side. And I grew up, you know, like I never met my biological father. My pop, who's been around since I was just over a year and some change, has never met his biological father. And he basically had to teach himself how to be a man. And he's very stoic. He holds it back. Like, he's one of those guys where I can count on one hand how many times I've ever seen him cry. And then I adopted that from him, which means I never really try to address my, like, feelings or any of that stuff. I just shove it on the side, bite my, you know what I mean? Like, bite some tree bark and keep it pushing. Is that, to go back to it, is that something, when you hear toxic masculinity, what comes to mind?
If it was cool, I wanted to share a story, man. Like,
much yeah, shorter, please.
And maybe I'll hit it. Maybe I'll
this
hit
is,
it.
I mean, this is a professor and a comedian walking to therapy, man. So let's do it. Let's get into
Maybe I'll hit toxic masculinity, because I didn't know you were going to throw that one, but it's all good. It may go, it may not go there. But I was at the Mariah Carey Christmas concert, is that what it's called, last night?
I gotta hear how you tie Mariah Carey and toxic masculinity.
Yeah. So I love that.
I always start this conversation when I was out of Mariah Carey.
David Blaine.
I couldn't even get out of my mouth. I was at the Mariah Carey. It was like eight words. I knew it was like eight words. Mariah. I saw fake snowflakes coming down because it's Arizona. I saw a Phoenix, like, fake snowflakes. You in Chicago? And I'm like, look at them fake snowflakes. And then my boy, who's
and
my
you were
brother,
confident
my,
in your masculinity.
That's
it.
I knew every word. He said that verbatim. He was hitting the notes. He was.
He's so happy CD. It's Christmas time.
My first CD was Vision of Love ever in my life. So I was present. I was like really present. And I saw the fake snowflakes, and at the same time, masculinity. My boys are texting me. I'm a texter, and they're like, "Look, man!" And my boy's hugging his daughter. She's like 15 in Dallas, Texas. He's at the Jake Paul. I saw Jake Paul sign in the back Arlington Arena, whatever, versus Tyson. So there's that.
His daughter, huh?
Yeah, he took his daughter to. He's watching that, and I'm missing that. I'm missing Tyson, Jake Paul, because I'm at Christmas.
And you trying to catch fake snowflakes with your tongue?
and they were literally throwing little snowflake papers down, right? My daughter was going like this. It was going like this, trying to catch the snowflakes, the little papers. And then, you know, my nine-year-old daughter had a candy cane sweater. My son had like a candy cane sweater. And all of a sudden, I sit there, and then somebody gave me some cinnamon rolls. My wife bought some, what do they call those cinnamon things, sticks? I'm trying to stay healthy, so I only went half on one. And I'm like, man, I haven't worked out in 2 weeks. Let me slow this down. Let me put it under my seat and just date. Where am I at? I looked up. All of a sudden, this guy comes out and he goes, "Phoenix, are you ready for Mariah Carey?" And it said New York on his sweater. And I'm like, wait a minute. What kind of energy is that? It says a Christmas party. So I look left to look at the DJ. And he's like, "Where my ladies at?" And he presses play. And all this Beyonce music starts coming on. And then Tupac, then California Love. I'm like, what happened to Silent Night, you know? Like, it became this whole other thing. It was like no Silent Night. It was like this whole other kind of club scene. Mm. It was like an hour of a club scene with my kids wearing the Candy King sweaters. And it finally transitioned to Mariah coming out. But what I was going to say is mental health, Christmas. Oh, yeah.
Toxic masculinity.
Maybe I'll touch it or not, man. But for a long time. It
doesn't matter.
Man, yeah, for a long time, man, I had trouble with Christmas. It was a lot for me mental health-wise. I wouldn't have been at the concert a few years ago, not because of toxic masculinity, but because of my inability to understand how I felt at Christmas when the presents weren't coming through. As basic as that sounds, there was a certain kind of injury I felt about, you know, some people got presents. Juanito didn't get presents, or not the ones he thought kids at my age should have gotten, or whatever. As generic as that sounds, there was a melancholy, man. It was a sadness about Christmas songs. I hated Charlie Brown. Like, that song. Like, when that came on, I was even though it was Cali and It's Always Sunny, my mood was going like this. And it would always dip. So there's just something really, I don't know, I'm not in that field, clinical psychology, right? But there's something really healing to run it back. Like, to run back the idea of Christmas being a place where I could be with my children, be at the Mariah Carey concert. They're wearing candy cane sweaters. I know some of the lyrics from All I Want for Christmas Is You because of the NBA commercials. I know those lyrics. We hear Christmas songs all the time.
Yeah.
You know?
He got frozen and he got
hey,
the
he
frozen
got the
playlist
poster
in
the
his car right
crib. Hey, I like the fact that he got mad when they were Tupac. He's like,
this is ridiculous.
Where's all this fun here? Where's Mariah? Why are you playing Tupac?
Where's all this toxic masculinity rap coming from?
I chose not to go see Tyson and Jake Paul. I made it an intentional, deliberate choice.
How dare you play Pac?
That's why I don't want like to be able to reconstruct.
That's
something
what
painful
I'm
from your
no,
past.
No, that's beautiful, man.
That's
beautiful.
Really hard to
it's
do,
beautiful.
Man.
You know,
Juan.
And it's good because you're, and this is what I love that you know, you didn't say it, but what you're doing is you're breaking the cycle from your past into making it better for your children, and that's where our goal is. At the end of the day, we have to learn to let go. And not completely, but to learn to change the narrative and break that cycle of, you know, because we grew up old school. You know, you talk about masculine toxic, you know, my dad never showed up for nothing. You know, my father runs the numbers in Brooklyn, New York. He's been running numbers for all his life, you know, works for the mob. And you know, I go see him now and I'm there 5 minutes and I know what I expected, you know, he's, oh, okay, I gotta go. He leaves, you know. My son saw him, you know, ain't seen him in 5 years. He said hi to him from the car. What's up? You know, and but, you know, I've learned, you know, that's who he is, because you have to understand that the same way. And Mike really nailed the nail on the coffin. What may see something small to us,
right,
may something major that happened to them. So I don't judge my father on his character now, because I've learned to forgive and understand that it's something that he went through that caused him to be who he is now. You understand? And, you know, that talks, you know, he told me some crazy stuff. You know, his brother passed away when his brother was only a month old. And they came to his house in Puerto Rico and measured the kid, that's the corpse, you know, to make the coffin right there at the house. I was like, ain't that some hillbilly freaking, you know what I'm saying? I said, what? I said, damn, they didn't. He said, yeah, they brought the box. I remember them measuring my brother with the tape and making the box. I'm like, this sounds like Little House on the Prairie, Dad. He goes, yeah, you know, and his mother lost it. And I asked Uncle, why do they always call you Fredo? Because his name is Juan. But in Puerto Rico, everybody calls him Fredo. And he said, well, my mother, that my brother's name was Fredo. And my mother lost her mind so much that when baptism, they just named me Fredo so that she would think that he's still alive because she had a nervous breakdown.
Holy moly.
That's how they dealt with things back then. So you look at that and it starts to all make sense. Now I understand why you are how you are. And I never understood it before. I would just judge him. I mean, my father ain't schmack. He ain't garbage. He's garbage. He's like, you know, he's a deadbeat. But he's not. He went through things that caused him to that he felt, I have to put up this shield to show I can't cry about it. I can't show emotion. I can't have empathy because I was raised not to. I can't be sad because I was raised not to. You know, as a kid, you fall, you better not cry. That's what I was told. When you fell and you could be bleeding out your head, Dad, I swear, if you cry, I'm going to hit you. I'm going to make it hurt more. And you're like, so you go up and say, I can't cry. And you don't realize that that builds and builds over time. And that's how you become, you know, and it does affect your relationships. It does affect your relationship.
Yeah.
You know, my father right now, none of the kids talk to him except for me. You know, my brother sometimes will call him, you know, once in a blue, but they've lost that connection with him because they're like, Dad, you are who you are. But I understand it's not who he is. It's what he's been through. You understand?
Exactly.
So, that's amazing. Man. That's amazing. Yeah, that's exactly what's blowing my mind is you actually just, I didn't actually, it hits me in waves. The some of the challenges of family and the PTSD that they might have suffered through before it got to me. And what you just said, Aunt, the reason it just cut to my core because I have an auntie. My grandmother on my mom's side she was pregnant three times, had five kids. So my mom's a twin. And then right above her was my Uncle David and my Aunt Denise. And my Uncle David, he passed away in prison back when I was like, you know, 1, 2 years old. And it threw my aunt Denise off to the point where she legally got her last name changed to Ann David, because her entire life growing up, she would always hear Denise and David. So for her to lose her
Wow.
twin, when she was so young,
Wow.
eventually at some point, and then she there's a lot of mental struggles on that side of my family. And what if I could ask Aunt, because you're a beacon. Anytime, any to understand, gang, if y'all haven't been to an Anthony Fuentes show, I don't know, you're starting to get a little too big and popular right now. But before the show, after the show, he's at every table. He's talking to every person in there, man, woman, child, young, old, sick, healthy. He's talking to everybody on a personal level. He's damn near working there. He'll go and grab you silverware and all that shit, and then go perform and then come back. He's an amazing dude. What
Wow.
for everything that you've been through in the past, and this is definitely opening you, Juan, opening you, Saper. What's one of the better tools if somebody listens to this and they're considering therapy, or they're actually looking at their lives and taking accountability? What's a tremendous tool that's worked for you outside of therapy that somebody can start, maybe, today, if they needed help getting over some mental hurdles, that's worked for anybody here?
Laugh. Laughter's healing. I some of my darkest times that I remember sitting at home in the living room, and I'm gonna be very candid. I remember sitting with a 38 Smith & Wesson snub nose on my pillow right here to the side of me, wondering, do I pull the trigger today? But watching some stand up and laughing, just cracking up. That little laughter changes a lot, smiling is contagious. There's a reason I tell my slogan is remember to laugh, because it's very important to learn to smile in the face of adversity. If you learn to smile, you can begin to heal. If you walk by somebody, they can look like them with a dog face, and you smile at them long enough, they're gonna smile. Even if they're like because it's contagious, and that's why I'm grateful for the platform that I have. That's why I go interact with every audience member, because I look at it as I'm blessed to be here. I could have not. There were so many times I tried and was f and failed and was unsuccessful in taking my own life. And I look at that as if I had that opportunity to be here now, then I have to make the best of every moment that I have right now, because there's a reason that I'm here. So I interact, and I say this a lot. People always ask me, like, what are your best interactions with people after the show? And it is great. I do meet and greets. I stay after the show. I do meet and greets because I feel like it's my job. This is my job. This is my job. I do it full time. I'm a full time comedian. So if you come to my show and you bought tickets, I'm not leaving. I'm the first one there and I'm the last one to leave, because it's my job. So I stay there and I meet and greet, and I hear people talk to me all the time. Oh man, this and that joke you did was funny, and it is a compliment when they remember your joke, because it means that it resonated with them. But the best feedback I've ever get is when someone comes up to me like, yo, I was having a really bad day mentally, or I've been going through some things mentally, and I needed this. Thank you. That to me, that's best compliment I could ever get, because this is why I'm doing it. And saying, yeah, I'm doing it to pay bills, but it's also underneath, this is why I'm doing it, because I know
Beautiful.
there's thousands of people there with the same struggle that I have, that are scared to talk, that are, so if I have the tool of laughter to bring to you, I'm gonna use it. And I use it for myself. Sometimes I sit back and I'll think to myself for something funny, because I gotta get through it. There's a picture this guy brought me, and I thought it was the greatest. It wasn't the fact that he painted it of me, but he came up to me after the show and he said, man, my mother just passed away from cancer. And I've been really dark here. And when he said here, I grabbed his hand. I said, say less. I already know where you're at. You understand? Here's my phone number. I didn't know this guy from Honolulu. Never met him a day in my life. But I know what it is to not have someone to talk to. And if he's strong enough to try to talk to me, I'm going to give him. I said, here's my phone number. And he's like, are you serious? I go, yeah, call me, bro. I've been there. I made a promise that when I meet someone like that, I'm gonna find a way to help, because no one was there to help me. You understand? So I gave him my number and he came to a show later on, and actually he's painted a portrait of me, painted it. Dude, got talent. And he was like, yo, I've learned to use, I started going to therapy and I've learned to use the passing of my mother as motivation for my art. So in the picture, I'm looking at it, that's why there's little lines in the picture. And he said, those are the EKG readings of my mother. So I keep her alive through the paintings.
Wow.
That is amazing, because you found amazing. A way to cope. You found something.
That's unbelievable. Wow.
You know, but it's, I thank God, because it's the tools I got. And, you know, and when I say God, I thank God. I don't care, you know, and that's the thing too, we have to understand with mental, you know, there's people who are Muslim, love them, bro. That's who they, that who am I to tell you you're wrong? And who are you to tell me I'm wrong? Maybe if we learn to just respect each other and respect each other's beliefs and opinions and love one another regardless of it. I said this at the beginning, you waste more energy being angry at somebody than you do just loving, you know? I got brothers who are Muslim. I served in Iraq, but they're my brothers. I love them, you understand? Eunice, you know Eunice, he's a comedian.
Yeah, yeah.
Muslim. Sure. I have conversations every day. And I tell him, Assalamu alaikum. You know why? Because I know that that's his belief. And I respect his belief because he is my brother. I don't care what he likes or what he dislikes. He is my brother. And if we can learn to try to be like that, the world would be a lot better place. Because that's the problem. We're always looking at each other. No, you're wrong. You have to believe this. No, you're wrong. You have to think this. Why? Why am I wrong? Why are you wrong? Who's the same? You understand? So, you know, I that's one thing when I say I thank God, firstly, because I've been offered the opportunity to not only it changed my life around, but help change others. So that's why when I get to a show, I speak to everybody because I did a show when I did Tempe, when I was in Tempe, Arizona, 500 plus people at the Improv. I was there for, I got there 2 hours early because I knew it was stop. And I walked to each 500 person, each table. Man, thanks for coming and cracked a little joke each table. Make them laugh a little bit before the show because I'm grateful that you're here. You understand?
That's amazing, man. Anthony, I can't wait. I can't wait to see you in person. So I'm going to
get connected. We'll be at a Mariah Carey concert. I promise that.
Well, I'm right. We can go together. We can go. You have a fam. We can all go together. Guys, let me say this. To wrap us up, because I want to be respectful of both of your time. This was an incredible, incredible episode. There were so many nuggets of wisdom and humor. I think we're going to put this episode behind a paywall, Mike. This one was too good. People have to pay for this. Yeah. You got to use your insurance. You got to bring out Blue Cross.
We got to be greedy when it comes to mental health.
This one.
Yeah, put a Mariah Carey track.
Absolutely. That's going to be. So look, there's two things. There were a lot of gems. There's two that I wrote down from Anthony that I'm just going to take with me going into the rest of my weekend. One is learn how to respect each other and learn how to smile in the face of adversity. I really appreciate you both, Juan and Anthony. I mean, I feel like we kind of know each other and we were sitting around having a Saturday morning coffee. So I hope we can do this again. Maybe we can do it in Tempe. Maybe we can do it. Juan, I got to bring you out here to Chicago. We can get together and go see Anthony or Mike perform and continue the conversation. It was great. Mike, any last words?
Nah, these gentlemen are tremendous. And already knows what time it is. But Juan, it was tremendous getting to talk to you and getting a little bit of knowledge from you, man. It's amazing. Congratulations and what you were able to get through, man, that actually legitimately broke my heart when you were talking about taking a look back and not being able to say, I have a support system there. So for you to be able to break through that and do it on your own and make something and hold a family down, man, hey, I'm proud of you because I know there's people important in my life that were able to do something similar and some people that didn't make it. So for you to be able to do that, man, that's special.
Thank you. Thank you for hosting me, man. And everything, the dialogue was inspirational. And Anthony, I just want to say, man, I'm going to see you when you come through. That's been one of my spots, a Tempe Improv, man.
Definitely, everything definitely. You do, I look forward to seeing you. He's like kind of in a piece of way. I got scared a little bit. He's like, I'm going to see you when you come back.
Yeah, he was. Talk
about that Mariah Carey.
High notes. Funny time.
High notes.
Don't break down, bro. Hey, all jokes aside, real talk, it's an honor to meet both of you. Mike is my brother. I love him to death since day one. Wow. Clicked and I fell in love with this brother. His, you know, his way of thinking. And that's why I agreed to do this. because the moment he asked, I said, man, I'm there like a square from Delaware. Sapere, so truly honored. You're a professor.
I am.
That's you. I would have thought you was in a hip hop video, bro. The way you dress, I would
have loved it. Yeah. He looks real like Onyx.
Yes, I love that, bro. No, because you know what? You see a lot, to see you guys like laid back like that's good because it shows that you guys are people of the people and that what you do because you love. You know, you got people who are like, no, I am. And the fact that you guys to us on that level, I truly admire both of you. I know what it takes to go to school, let alone to become a professor. That's truly my hats off to both of you. I mean that, Juan, when I go to Tempe, I'll definitely see you.
I'm going to make sure y'all get y'all information. I'm going to make sure that we get our information.
We'll all get connected. We'll all get connected.
I want to go back to In-N-Out and
oh, we got In-N-Out. That in we Tempe. Got you.
Yeah, I went there in Whataburger because Texas has Whataburger and had it in Arizona. I said, what? Say less. I'm there. Yeah, so,
and I got a crew, so you're going to meet some good people, man.
That's what it is.
Yeah. Respect all around. Just respect all around. Again, I just want to like really express my gratitude. Like, we really got personal, too, in this episode. And I think it got it again, like, the essence of what Mike and I are trying to do, just conversations about a bunch of topics. And we flowed through a few of them, and we shared stories. I really appreciate the vulnerability, the honesty, the leaning in, the respect, and the laughter. So thank you all. Audience members, tune in, subscribe. I hope you like this episode. We have more.
Please drop more a like. Please subscribe. Please tell a friend to tell a friend.
Yo, PCWB, I'm your co-host, Sapere Vakil.
I'm your co-host, Mike Knight.
Peace.
Peace.
Later.